Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Kelly. And thank you, Deanna, for having us. Kelly is right. We share a lot of themes and interests in our poetry. We both have a great interest in the notion of place and why that's important to us and what effect that has on us. The poems that I'm going to read you come from my book, Motherlode. They are largely about my mother's childhood in Nazi-occupied Holland. The book came largely out of a desire to understand that past. My siblings and I, my siblings who are in the room tonight, I'm very happy that they're here. We grew up hearing stories, very sort of superficial stories from my mother about the fact that her family hid Jews during the Nazi occupation and our grandfather worked with the Dutch resistance. But it was very superficial. They were sort of like family legends. And one day my son Eric said to me, what did Oma's family really do? And I told the superficial stories again because they were all that I knew. And he wanted to know more and I couldn't tell him more. And it made me think, well, if I don't find out the real story, then, you know, when our mother should pass away, we will have lost this. So I asked my mother if she would be willing to go deep into the past and sort of rediscover what she lived as a child. And she was quite reluctant. She, in fact, was very reluctant. But in the end, she said to me, you know, I'm going to do this for you. And she made it very clear that it was because I was her daughter that she would do it. Apparently, her younger brothers had asked her to tell the story of what their childhood was like in Holland, and she didn't want to go there. She didn't want to dig it up again. So the poems that I will read you tonight will kind of tell you a little of the story of that discovery, and they will also tell you the similar stories from the perspective of other people who lived their childhoods in Nazi-occupied Holland. People that I interviewed who were a little older than my mom and whose memories were a lot stronger. But I'll start with the part of the book that tells my mother's story. And the first poem that I will read you is called Letters from a War Child. And it's really about the process of discovering my mom's past through writing letters. Because since we don't live in the same city, there were lots of conversations on the phone. But my mom likes to write letters, so it made her happy to be able to tell me these stories through writing. Letters from a War Child. The letters are like a run-on sentence, words, emotions, spilling from my mother as though they will get away from her if she doesn't hurry. She glosses over the ugly parts of the war, claiming a faulty memory, but remembers with candid detail the things that brought her joy. Flowers in her small garden, her father's aviary, homegrown honey, the fairy story elements of her young life. Today, she only watches movies with happy endings, reads romance novels that turn out right, no war films or documentaries, the hiss-bang of dropping bombs, the frantic pitch of air raid sirens send her diving for cover. I wonder at this denial, chase her sentences as they run underground, mine them for all that got left behind, for all that she does not want to find. My mother had a friend during her childhood. Her name was Geisha. And she told me about her a couple of times, but the memories were kind of skimpy for her. After 40 years, I believe, she went back to Holland for the first time in 1993 and again in 1995. And she managed to get in touch with Geisha and met with her. And this is a little story of that. This poem is called Cat Got Your Tongue. She'd come with bruises and excuses. Her name was Geisha, and she was my best friend at school. Mother dead, father and brother to care for, and for her and her sister, and care they did. It was wartime. Everyone was taking what wasn't theirs, so they took her too. When social services got wind, they put her in a foster home. I saw her 40 years later on my first trip home. We cried, didn't have anything to say. Too many words, no tongue to find them. Her name was Geisha, and she was my best friend. In 2010, that was the year that I started this project, and I decided to go to the Netherlands to do a little research about my mom's past. And actually, what I really wanted to do was visit her childhood home, which was still standing. And we as kids saw this picture. This house here is her home. And she had seen it when she went back in 1993 and 1995. And I really wanted to see it for myself. So when I went to Amsterdam in 2010, at the pushing of my husband, I did a lot of research there. I went to a number of museums to seek the past, to find out how people lived during that time. And I also went to my mom's house. This poem is called The Librarian. It's about some research that I did at the Jewish Historical Museum. In heavily accented English, she tells me over coffee that some Dutch citizens made Jews pay to be hidden during the war. I don't want to believe her, but I know shelves and cabinets of documentation must hold some truth. She is insistent. She is Dutch herself, speaking the wrongs of her own people. I hold tight to my family's Christian values of helping the hunted, take refuge in the fact that they never exacted such payment. Months later, I will learn that the Dutch boasted a higher rate of turning in Jews than any other occupied country. Now, when I dip speculaas in my coffee, anticipating the melting morsels on my tongue, they disintegrate, crumbs sticking to the bottom of the cup, like sediment. And I should mention that speculaas are the Dutch cookies that I bring to work, the ginger cookies that those of us who have European parents know that you must dip into your coffee and make them all soggy, and then eat them. This next poem is called The Hunger Winter, 1944-1945. It's about my mother's memories of her father when he came home from working on the Dutch resistance during that winter. I remember my small hands pulling up his covers, being startled by his raspy breath, coming from a mouth, a face I didn't recognize. My father was oh so thin. I must have been six when I saw him, there on the divan in the living room, bright light filtering in, scattered on a hollow face. I remember Mama offering thin soups made of vegetables from jars in the cellar, from potatoes she had hidden under straw. We had just enough, but he and his fellow resistance fighters ate tulip bulbs, toxins from their onion-like centers coursing through their bodies covered in skin and bone, bodies fighting two wars. After that, tulips never looked the same to me. And it's kind of an interesting story because tulips are indeed my mother's favorite flower. This next poem is called The Red Boots, and it's a complete and utter work of fiction, except for the fact that I have a pair of red boots that I really love. And the boots inspired me. I should preface this poem with the fact that my mother's father, our grandfather, was a shoemaker. So the making of shoes, the importance of leather, is something that we grew up hearing about. The red boots. She has been waiting for days to show me the red boots, pulls me into the store. Smell the leather, my daughter cries, running her hands along the fine workmanship. I take the boot, bring it to my nose, feel the swell of memory, searing, burning my nostrils. I'm back in my father's shoemaking shop, in our small Dutch village, the tanned hides stacked one upon the other, disguising the hollow in the floor where we hid Jews. Smell of life, smell of death, those who escaped, those who died trying, all the faces I can't remember. By them, I say, they make such a statement. But she can't possibly know what I mean. This next poem is called The Collection, and it's less about my mother than it is about a woman that I interviewed later in the research of this book. Her name was Libby Bolin Emond, and she was, my mother, when the war ended, was seven, and Libby was 12 when the war ended, and has had much stronger memories. In fact, I still visit her, and she still tells me stories. In fact, sometimes she tells the same stories But the memories are so strong for her, and when she starts describing things, it's like she's transported into another time. She's in a completely other world. The collection. We imagined the explosions, how they deformed the metal, made them into works of art. We had a contest to see who could collect the most unusual pieces, shape, length, sharpness. This was war, benign behind the front lines, until the day the Allied forces launched an air attack on our town. Column of German soldiers walking our street, noise of car and truck engines drowning out the roar of air raid sirens, grandfather screaming at us to get inside, seek cover in the sub-basement. When it was over, he let us come up, but he wouldn't let us outside. Bits of bodies littered the street. Afterwards, we threw out our pieces, never looked for shrapnel again. This is also about Libby, a story that she remembers from her childhood. What Lisbeth knows. Lisbeth, so young, but she knows something so wrong. She is staying at Tante Yanni's, relief from chaos in Nijmegen, but Jews still feel fearful here in Oss. Lisbeth knows the family across the street is Jewish, sees the small boy in his papa's arms. Next day, same baby with another man, acting like a papa too. Lisbeth nudges her mama. Why, she asks, why? You did not see that child, she answers, you did not see. Lisbeth, so young, but she knows to be quiet. This next poem is also about Libby. She told me that during the worst periods of the fighting, she was in a town called Nijmegen, and there was some fierce fighting there. Her parents, who were quite wealthy, they sent her and her brother to a pensionnat in Belgium. And she told me the name of it. It was called Institut Henri Jaspar in Brussels. And I thought, well, I'm gonna do a little search and see what I find. Well, what I came across was the work of a photographer who had photographed this institute in its state today. So it's still standing, but it is completely covered in graffiti. It is a disaster, but it's still standing, and she didn't know that it was still in existence. So I told her about it, I told her to go look, and she was quite stunned to see the places where she had slept, the bathrooms that she had used, in complete disrepair and with graffiti written everywhere. And it was quite shocking for her, but it made me able to write about her experience, or what I imagined her experience to be, because suddenly I could see it for myself. Institut Henri Jaspar, Brussels. Peeling paint, narrow hallways, shadows run on mint green walls. I peer into the stairwells, see smashed windows, shards of glass. On the landing, in the bathroom, rows of sinks, some hang precariously, others with broken pipes. Here, I washed my face. Bathtub where I once soaked, now lined with rust, bottom coated with dried sludge. I arrived on 24th of December 1944 here, where the children of employees from a prominent Belgian company used to vacation, now a hostel for young war refugees from France, Holland, beyond. We stripped, were checked for lice, I had nits. Were given night clothes, shoes, uniforms, were fattened up, weighed weekly, followed by doctors, kept safe. The war ended in May, the Red Cross slow to send us home. While we waited, we watched the forest, we searched the forests, pretended we were girl guides, played games of looking for Hitler. So much untold today by the graffiti on the walls. When I was in Amsterdam, I walked around a lot. The first day that I was there, I was in a part of Amsterdam near the train station, which is called the Jordaan, and there are a lot of cute little shops on this street, a lot of coffee houses, so a lot of smells of marijuana emitting, but it was a very sort of hippie kind of place, and it was fun to walk around there. And I walked into a store called Het Grote Avontuur, so the Big Adventure, And the woman who ran the store, we just started talking, and I was telling her how much I liked the blue dishes. My mother collects Delft's blue. Probably many of you have seen this blue pottery from the Netherlands. And so the woman who was running the store, she said, "Well, actually, those dishes are French." So I was like, "Okay, sorry about that." So, but interestingly enough, I basically was rather forthcoming with anyone that I would meet. I told them why I was there, what I was doing. And so I told her about my book project, which was very embryonic at the time. And interestingly enough, she said, "Well, you know, my grandparents were also working for the Dutch resistance. And her grandmother was actually married to a relative of the German artist Escher. And so both grandparents actually were working for the Dutch resistance. And this is the story of her grandmother, who was named Charlotte. It's more of a prose piece, less of a poem. It's called Lottie's Journey. And again, as I do so often, I try to imagine what it would have felt like to be in that situation, and this is my imagining of what Lottie must have gone through on this day. "I've walked all the way from Bennekom to Angstgeest to tell them. Jan's poor parents learning of their son's death in this way. I offer our baby 6 months in my rounding belly as consolation. A life for a life. But I know it's not enough. The police are waiting there to take me to a prison in Arnhem. They are respectful, and I, too, am filled with despair, too much despair to be scared. I go with them, Jan's parents weeping at my leaving. They've lost a son and fear they will never see their grandchild come into the world. I ride silently to the jail, feigning sleep so the officers cannot ask me questions. I don't know what will happen when I get there and try to wipe my mind clear. 4 days, 4 endless days of hearings follow. They ask me the same questions over and over. How did I help plan to bomb the railway? What did I know about my husband's resistance work? What did I do to help? I don't tell them about the weapons wrapped up in my basket, the newspapers that line the bottom. I only tell them about the food I brought to hungry families. I tell them calmly, my voice never wavering. Even when they show me his burned clothes, I do not falter as I rub my belly, look down absently at the baby's form or beyond them at some random point on the wall. They cannot break me. No one can touch me here. No one can take away what is left of Jan. They tire of always hearing the same answers of my blank expression. To them, I am just a stupid pregnant woman who knows nothing. When they finally release me, I return to Jan's parents, show them their unborn grandchild. I'm going to read one last poem. It's not from Motherlode. It's from my next book, which is going to come out sometime in the fall, called Journey Woman. So it's a bit of a departure from what I've read, but definitely self-reflecting. In 2012, I decided that I wanted to go to a monastery just to find out what it was like to reflect alone for more than 24 hours. I wanted to find out what it would be like to not talk to anyone for 24 hours or longer. I was there a little longer than 24 hours. I went to a place on the northern part of the island called the Recluse Sisters. This is an organization that is evangelistic in its approach. They believe in prayer and quiet and working with your hands. And they work solemnly and dedicatedly towards the sainting of a Montreal religious figure who's called Jean Labarre. So in my 24, 36 hours there, this long poem, which is composed of 4 smaller poems, is a mix of my reflections and my own, what I thought that Jean Labarre might have lived through. The first part's called Reclusion. By 5 p.m., I have a headache from the silence. So unused am I to not speaking. I consider this perpetual state of contemplation versus action and am conflicted. The simplicity is intoxicating. I watch the sisters in their blue habits, soft-soled shoes, almost soundless as they glide down hallways. Their glasses are unadorning, practical. No makeup rims their eyes, no jewels frame their faces. Only gray hairlines under starched white headpieces. I look at all my bags, unpack shoes, hang up clothes, consider strewn cosmetics, see no shortage of books, paper, iPod, revealing my fear of having nothing to do. 2, the call. I make hot chocolate with a Spanish woman named Nellie in the only room where talking is allowed. She is 72, looks in her late 50s, tells me she teaches kindergarten, goes on retreats 3 times a year. I tell her I am here to write, to understand solitude, to walk with God. She tells me to call the number on the plastified card in my room. Ask a sister. Don't leave without answers, she says. When Sister Solange comes to lock up, I ask her for 15 minutes. She gives me 40. Tells me she did not make a choice. God chose her. She asked him where he wanted her, felt the click into place when she came here. I feel reproached by her conviction. I didn't hear the call. I never got one. She used to think happiness was la grande fête. Now she knows it's just a kind of peace within. I pick up my pen and write. Another call, a different peace. 3, 34 years in solitude. I flew the coop at the age she chose God, tried to set down roots when I was barely old enough to fly. JLB had money, beauty, an appropriate suitor. Chose instead to embroider 8 hours a day, pray, meditate for 6 more, sleep for 5, spend a mere hour on bodily ministrations, and I am already lonely for husband, son, comforts. 4, the vocation of Jeanne Labarre. I cannot, will not speak, but I can light this world with gold and silver threads, wool and silk patterns to supply all la Ville-Marie with copes, dalmatics, chasubles, and altar cloths. I will lace them with rosebuds and blooms, carnations, peonies, poppies, God's work in brilliant nuances. I will avoid idleness, work my hands to clothe the poor, use my money to establish a school for impoverished girls. My silence, much of it spent in prayer, will weigh more than all words. God willing, the images I stitch will stay. Thank you.